Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is Assistant Director of Ops at NWRDC, John Welch. John, welcome.
Hey.
Hey, I'm so pleased to have you on the show. We've known each other for quite a long time, and I'm very familiar with your technical background as an IT administrator, and you just have an awesome career arc, and you just know the Mac inside and out, and I've been dying to have you on the show for a while. So welcome to the Background Mode.
No, thank you.
As you know, Background Mode goes into a little bit about the inspirations and the background of the guest, and then in the second half of the show, we get into the technical and geeky stuff. So I was reading about your background. Tell me what you were thinking prior to all this wonderful experience in industry and tech and Mac. What were you thinking about in college? Were you early on already on that path, or were you thinking about something else?
My first round in college, because I've had a few, I was realizing that I can't program that well. I was trying to do a comp sci degree, and whatever mental thing makes someone a programmer, I don't got. I can fix things, I can put things together, I can bang out scripts as I need to, but I learned over the years that the idea of sitting there and typing code and coding and the whole thing, it's cool, it's great, people get a lot of enjoyment and reward out of it, and I would rather eat my own shoes than do it full time.
It's not for everyone, for sure.
Yeah, it really isn't. I mean, it's a useful skill, but it's never been something that I liked to do, I guess. And I always had a problem, like most of the major syntax types, C syntax, JavaScript dot syntax, I can't keep it in my head long enough to use it anyways.
So as an IT administrator, one does have to occasionally do a little bit of Perl or C shell.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did that work?
That works out pretty well, but that's really focused. And a lot of times you're not having to sit there and create something from nothing. Someone else has already had your problem. So a lot of it is knowing a given language, whether it's Bash, Perl, AppleScript, whatever, to use someone else's starting point modified for your needs. You don't have to sit there and reinvent the wheel a whole lot.
Yeah, it is a special skill. My wife teaches programming Java and C++. At a community college, and she gets to see the whole gamut of people who just can't quite buckle down and adhere to syntax and follow the rules. They want to do it their own way, and it doesn't work. So your first job out of college was working in Grand Forks with the B-1B bomber, and I really got lit up when I first heard about that, and I've heard you talk about that experience. How did you get that job, and what did you do with the B-1?
Well, the way I got it was I flunked out of college. I literally got the note from FIU going goodbye, which it was the early 80s. I lived in Miami, and two of my roommates were DJs. Studying was kind of not the priority it should have been. And so I literally walked down to the payphone, called local Air Force recruiter, and said, I want to join the Air Force. And the opening they had that got me in the fastest was electronic warfare. At the time, it was a 328X3, I think.
Why? Because you had a pulse?
Well, no. I mean, literally, I just wanted to get in the Air Force the fastest. Yeah. What I would have rather done was explosive ordnance disposal, because that was cooler. But that would have taken 7 months.
No, slow down. So you realize you didn't have an interest in programming. How was it? I'm curious. How was it that suddenly you had an interest in the military? How did that happen?
Well, I'd always been into airplanes.
Was your father in the military?
He was in the Army. But, I mean, I'd been around airplanes all my life. My dad and I would go when you could still do this and hang out at the end of runways and watch planes go overhead. Mm-hmm. I stayed home to watch the first shuttle launch. I had books on airplanes and basically airplanes and dinosaurs.
That'll do it.
Yeah. And so it was kind of a natural fit. And electronic warfare turned out to be really cool. Radar jammers are pretty cool. And when I was in tech school, this announcement comes over the overhead speakers saying, if you want to volunteer to be on the B-1, here's where you sign up. But I did it as a lark. I mean, I'm, you know, barely out of basic. I've got no experience. We all figured they're going to take all the people who've been doing this a while, and the rest of us would go to where we were going to go, wherever that was. About 4 months later, announcement comes over that says, all non-prior service personnel, namely people like me, who signed up for the B-1 were accepted. All prior service personnel who signed up for the B-1 were not accepted. And so where I was going after tech school changed from Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in Arizona to Grand Forks Air Force Base in North Dakota. And that was how I got on the B-1, working on the radar jamming systems, the nav systems, and a lot of the communication systems.
You mentioned in your bio that in the early days, the B-1 was much maligned. I always thought it was a beautiful aircraft, and it's still in use today.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a fantastic aircraft. But early on, it had a lot of problems. You know, amusingly enough, part of the going from the B-1A to the B-1B was modifying it so it was a low-level bomber, not a high-level Mach 2 bomber, but a low-level transonic bomber. It can break Mach, but not by much. And one of the criticisms was it couldn't go fast or high. It was like, that's by design.
Well, fast or high is where you get shot down by first radar, yeah, which picks you up at a high altitude. And that's why the B-70 was killed, right? Because flying high and fast, except for, unless you're a SR-71, doesn't get you much.
Yeah. Well, the XB-70 could fly as high and fast as the SR-71. It was also a lot more expensive, and instead of using conventional JP-4 fuel, it used this weird boron hydrogen slurry thing. Mm. It was a neat test bed, but it was never going to be practical as a plane, as a bomber.
Yeah, because you're right up there and the radar sees you, and those Patriot-like missiles can just go up and zap you at 60,000 feet. So,
Well, it would have been cooking along at Mach 3, but it just, the design was never that practical. But the B-1 was, and it had some problems early on.
What did it take to modify the B-1 to do low-level ground support? Which is kind of an interesting thing to begin with when you have a 300,000-pound plane flying.
More like 400,000 pounds empty. A lot of it was they modified the a lot of the fuel tank stuff, the fuel center gravity management system, which is known as the FUGM system, and the G sound is really important in that. They modified the engine intakes. The engine inlet vanes weren't adjustable anymore. They did a lot of modifications to beef up the frame to handle the stress of flying low level and the
turbulence.
Maneuvers.
Yeah.
Also, just train following. There's a lot of maneuvering going on that you don't have at high level. A few other things. A lot of it was just structural stuff.
And you got a lot of endurance on that plane, too. It can do orbits, right, and just kind of sit up there. And when it's called upon, it can just jump out of orbit. And I don't mean Earth orbit. I mean a circle orbit. And just, jump into an assignment.
Yeah. Basically, from what I've read, what it'll do is it takes off and it just flies in a big circle kind of near where it might be needed.
Yep.
And then someone calls in for ground support and it dips down, hums along about 50 feet off the ground, drops a couple of bombs and goes away and then orbits again until it's needed.
Did you ever get a ride as a tech? Sometimes you get a chance to do a test ride.
No, because I wasn't on day shift and only day shift people got rides. Midshift people, we did all the work, but they weren't going to put us in the plane. It's
too bad.
There's a lot of us that have some sore spots with that. And if anyone from the Air Force is listening and can swing a ride in a B-1, dude, I will time and place. I will be there.
All right. Well, we got to move on. So after that, you had a succession of just jaw-dropping jobs in IT. Tell me how you got into MIT, and then what happened next?
The company I was working for at the time went under because of 911 and bad management. And I knew some folks who worked at MIT because it's Boston. There's a lot of people who do. And they hooked me up with an opening in the MIT cop shop as their IT manager, and I just hung out there for a while and then moved into central IT.
Did you do a voluntary departure from military service at some point and then move on to that?
Yeah. Yeah, I got out in 93, separated voluntarily, and started working IT for the city of Pinellas Park in Florida, and then just kind of vaguely wandered along. It's less of an interesting career arc from my point of view, more like, well, I've been here for a while. This is kind of dull. What can I do next? Well, that could be cool. Let me try for that. Hey, it worked.
A lot of my guests have that happen. They know somebody. They have some special skill. right time, right place, right person. It happens, and then they're off and running.
Yeah.
So when I got to know you, what did you do at MIT, and how did that develop your career?
Well, for a while, I was the IT manager, the IT department for the MIT police, which was really interesting.
Why?
Well, I mean, for one thing, it's just, you know, police IT is different. They have some interesting rules they have to deal with and stuff like that. And there were a couple of cases where they had busted a couple of students who were basically selling stolen computer gear out of their dorm room, and they needed someone who could go in and kind of help them catalog it.
Mm.
So after they'd done the interesting part, the arrest, I sat there with them and helped them, and that's a router, that's a switch, that's a, you know, kind of a thing. So that was kind of interesting in getting to know those folks and things like that. MIT, unlike Harvard or a lot of what you would think of as a traditional university, is very much what you would call an urban campus. It's in the more working class part of Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's got some interesting buildings, and you sort of know when you're on the MIT campus, but there's no like walls. It's not separated. You know, you can, one minute you're in front of an MIT building, next minute you're in front of a Dunkin' Donuts.
Ah, that can explain kinds of things that were happening.
Yeah.
So when I got to know you, I had just joined Apple, and I think you had just joined Kansas City Life. How did you navigate out there?
MIT had at some point made some interesting economic decisions regarding the dot-com boom in the late 90s. One of them being that everything would continue to go up at about 10 to 15% per year, at least as I heard it. And that didn't happen. And so like a lot of places, especially, you know, they were dependent on, a lot of MIT's money comes from government contracts, private contracts. And so they had to lay off about a third of their central IT staff, which I happened to be at the time. So on the same day, I got a really good review and a layoff notice. And I put the word out among people I knew that, hey, this had happened and I was looking for a new gig. And a friend of mine who is fairly high up at Kansas City Life was able to help me out, and I went out there.
Connect. This sounds like James Burke connections.
Well, I mean, a lot of it, though, is cool. As anyone knows, a lot of times you don't get jobs just random, you know, sending in resumes. You know someone, and they know someone, and things like that.
That's right.
I had actually sent in my resume because I know that Hallmark, the card company, is a huge setup out just outside of Kansas City, and they have a lot of Macs. And so I'd said, you know, if you know someone there, can you send him my resume? And he looked at it and went, we could actually use you here.
What did you do for Kansas City Life?
Some executive support. I was in the desktop, not the immediate help desk, but
executive
above
support.
That.
Is that a euphemism for keeping the vice president's Mac running?
Among other things, they had some Macs in their internal design group.
Mm-hmm.
And they just didn't have anyone who really knew a lot about them. And so I was able to do that. And I knew more than a little bit about Wi-Fi, so I was able to help them with that. I'd actually had some solid experience with Active Directory, things like that. It, you know, turned out I knew more than just how to keep Macs running.
Did you fall into Unix and Linux at this point, or had that already happened?
That had already happened. I first started dealing with Unix when I worked for a weather science company, and they were primarily a Solaris shop.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And so
I've used Solaris. It's pretty nice.
Yeah, so this was around Solaris 2.6, 2.7.
Yeah, that's where I was. Yeah.
We had some SGI boxes, some AIX boxes, things like that.
And you put CDE on top of it, it was a lot better.
Yeah. Yeah, well, CDE had its moments, but it was better than your other options.
But yeah, it was better than nothing.
Yeah, well, I will say SGI had probably one of the nicest Unix desktops I've ever seen.
I had an SGI Indy on my desktop when I was in Oak Ridge, and it was just an awesome machine. Yeah.
Yeah. So I learned a lot there. It's where I first started dealing with things like SNMP and stuff like that. And it was kind of funny because we use PowerMac 8600 for our web and FTP server, and I was getting uptimes on that of like 18 months. which, you know, macOS 8.5, 8.6, people like, how are you doing that? Well, it turned out I was doing what you were supposed to do. It had no extensions that weren't needed to run, you know, WebStar and Rumpus. It literally, all it did was that.
I wish I could get 24 hours of uptime on High Sierra.
I don't know everybody's having problems with mine runs. I've got 3-4 machines on it and they're running just fine. But I
need to do a clean install maybe or something.
Oh, dude, yeah. I have one installing on a machine I've been bringing along since forever. But I'm not clever deliberately. I don't do a lot of tweaks on things. I run a really generic system. Like, I know, you know, everybody's, you know, well, I do all this with Onyx and I never do any of that. Like, I don't do anything resembling a maintenance action unless something's going wrong. I don't go dinking with things unless I have a clear need to. I think the only really defaults mod I've made that wasn't required was I set up one for returning the power button so it brings up the logout screen. That's my big mod. I just run.
Okay. Yeah. Well, this is a good time to take a break. When we come back, I want to ask you about life at NWRDC, Florida State. But first, we have to take a commercial break. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. We're back. So we're back. I'm talking with John Welsh, expert IT administrator and assistant director of ops at the NWRDC. So how did you end up at Florida State then?
I live in Tallahassee, which is basically a company town. The company, well, two companies, state government or FSU. And I saw I would check the FSU jobs page and I saw the position opened up and it looked interesting. So I went for it.
Cool. And what are your duties there?
All kinds of things. I'm in charge of our operations staff, which is 24/7, keeping an eye on the building, things like that, testing the generators, that kind of thing. A lot of facilities and infrastructure, physical infrastructure. I also run a lot of our monitoring efforts, things like that. A little bit of this, a little bit of that.
You still get a chance to work with Macs on the network?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my desktop's a little 13-inch MacBook Pro. A lot of the monitoring stuff runs in Linux, and so having, you know, Unix as a desktop OS is kind of handy.
Yeah, it actually is. Do you have any issues with BSD on the Mac having to interface with other systems?
Never.
No. You just SSH primarily? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty easy. So you've had quite a career, and as I said at the top of the show, in the times I've encountered you, I've been in awe of your expertise. And that's why in the second half of the show, I want to ask you about some issues that I think you would be an expert to talk about. So I want to ask you about some Macintosh things, because I think you know a lot about this stuff. You know, there's a macOS server, and when it came along, I don't remember. It was probably up there from the beginning. We don't hear much about macOS server anymore. It's hardly on anybody's radar. Is it still in use? Do you still use it?
I don't, but I'm in a very extensive AD environment, Active Directory, so there's no need for it. Server to me was always one of those things that it was kind of like the Xserve and the Xserve RAID in a sense. I don't think it's ever been intended as a permanent product, and a lot of what it does has been rolled into the OS over the years. But it did what it was supposed to do, which created the idea that there's a need to do things that help, that are of use to Mac users and to, you know, later iOS users, mobile device management, file sharing, things like that. And so, like, you know, if you compare OneU server prices before the XServe to what they cost now, you can see this insane drop. The same thing with low-ish end storage with the XServe RAID when it just gutted the prices on those. I mean, when the XServe RAID came out, a fiber channel card would cost you almost $2,000, and Apple started selling them for $400, which is kind of amusing to think of Apple as the low price leader, but it really was. And Server now is a set of, it's really designed for very small uses.
So small business wants to set up an email server and do something.
Like 5-10 people, things like that.
Yeah.
Some basic device management. I wouldn't use it on anything over about 50 people. It's really not designed for that. And Apple keeps up with it, but you can tell they never put a lot into it than more than they had to. And if you think about it, with the server market being what it is and how it actually works, it's never been a good fit for Apple. They were never going to hire enough people to make themselves into a real enterprise vendor. They do well in the enterprise, but where they do well in the enterprise is by creating desktops and mobile devices that can work easily with almost any enterprise system. And so it was working well with others is where their enterprise strength has been, which you see by a lot of the IBMs, the Walmarts, all these people buying this stuff by, you know, Macs in the hundreds of thousands now. So it's there. It's free. It has some useful stuff.
macOS Server? I thought there was a small charge for that, like $20.
No, I think it's free now. But if it's $20, it's $20. I could be wrong. I haven't looked at it in a bit. But either way, it's basically free. It's if it's $20, okay. You don't buy a pizza that week. You owe us 10 server.
It's got some remote administration tools, right? So you can reach out, configure Constellation, Max, things like that.
Yeah, mostly it's a lot of SSH stuff, but it's got some remote GUI stuff you can do with it and things like that. And, you know, I mean, really, they've put more work into Apple Remote Desktop in a lot of ways than server. And I don't think that's bad. I think it's Apple knows where its strengths are. Apple, as you know, Apple is pretty good at knowing where it's going to make money and where it needs to be.
Yeah. Can Mac still do a net boot? I know that was a big thing when I was back at Apple, but it was kind of glitchy and there were some issues with it.
No, net boot works. There's a lot of people who use it, but I think especially...
We don't hear much about that
either. Well, it's kind of an odd thing because nowadays, you know, especially with how Apple ships the OS and stuff, there's really not a need to do it. You don't need to, you know, it comes with a perfectly good OS. There's no need to re-image it just to put an OS on it. You don't have a lot of cases where people are even using labs for that anymore. Everybody's, you know, using network home directories and stuff. You know, it's all mobile accounts, bring your own device, things like that. So the need for NetBoot is less. Most of what NetBoot's used for now is the installation part of it, which is the last bit of imaging Apple's still really doing net install. And it's usable for that, and it's really good for that. But, you know, they're changing. They're trying to get people away from doing this monolithic imaging where you wipe the entire machine when it comes out of the box. When it comes out of the box, the idea is now is it's got the OS. It's already attached to your management system out of the box. You just hand the box to the person who's going to use it. They open it up and start using it, and it all happens in the background. And you don't have to have, you know, an IT person or a string of IT people touching the device. You need that more. That doesn't hold as well in K-12 as it does in other places, but especially in enterprise, a lot of the stuff they've done, it's designed around you don't need to have an administrator just to get a computer ready to work.
Right, right. Speaking of administrators, were you aware of the root fiasco before it went public?
Because
I heard about it
in the leading edge of it. I'm on a couple of Slack channels, Mac admins, and some other things. It was bad, but in a lot of ways, I think, God, it was so, like, this is the worst thing Apple's ever done. And I'm like, no, the iTunes installer that wiped your hard drive was worse.
Well, one wonders about all the people who walked away from their Macs and left the, you know, alone, and somebody walked up to the Mac and logged in as root and did some stuff. We don't know how many times that happened and where, and how and who.
That's but here's worrisome. The thing. Well, but it's less worrisome than it might be because of system integration protection, where even if you log in as root, there's parts of the file system and the operating system you can't modify.
Yeah, but you might have been able to just log on, stick a USB drive in there, install a keylogger, and walk away and be done, you know?
Yeah, but you don't even need, if you're going to do that, you just get an inline USB keylogger, plug it into the keyboard cable, and it'll send you everything you need to know via Wi-Fi.
So your thought is that it's not the worst mistake Apple's made in history.
No, it was pretty bad, and you can because no one really logs in as root in OS X, you're always using sudo. I mean, the account's disabled by default. And so I can easily see where no one just tried it because you don't need it. And people test what they need. When new versions of the OS come out, I live with it because that way I can use it and everything. I can see how it's going to work for everything I do, not just controlled test cases. And I haven't logged in as root since maybe OS 10 version 1.2.
Yeah, same here.
I can see how the bug escaped. It was a dumb bug. It should have been caught.
It didn't appear in El Capitan or Sierra because we tested it there at Mac Observer.
Yeah.
How do you think it got introduced? Do you have some notion?
No, but I mean, when you're talking about major operating system stuff, you see stuff that just goes weird, that someone doesn't test something, there's a change that someone didn't think would affect something, and it actually did. There's a lot of things like that. I mean,
you think Apple needs more expertise in the Unix area?
There's this myth that ever since Steve is gone, ever since iOS, and I'm like, okay, so
ever since Jordan Hubbard left,
yeah, that you've got an installer, pre iOS during the magic time of Steve that wiped hard drives. Between 10.0 and 10.2, there was a file system bug that would randomly truncate large files, like Entourage databases and backup sets.
Yeah.
Things like that, video files. There was the one that William Carroll found where if you had a any random DHCP server and any random LDAP server, and you put out the right information in the right DHCP field, every Mac that was talking to your DHCP server would be bound, unauthenticated, but bound to the LDAP server, and you now had remote admin access to all those Macs, and it required no action from the human whatsoever.
Wow, I didn't hear about that one.
Yeah, well, that one was a little bit weird to wrap your head around, but that was a serious bug. There's been, and that happened during, I think, the 10.4 timeline, 10.3, 10.4. There's always been stuff like this. Every operating system has this, and the more complicated the code, I'm not saying that wasn't a bad bug. It was, and Apple, to their credit, acted really fast to get the patch out there.
Yeah, but then when you install 10.3.1, it undid it.
Well, yeah, but if you think about it, 10.3.1, they had a choice, either get the patch out there and then, 10.13.1, get the patch out there, and then when 10.3.1 is installed, the patch isn't going to be in that code base because that code was probably frozen well before the patch came out.
Yeah, well, you'd think they would patch the patch.
Yeah, but then you have to retest the patch.
Well, let's do that.
Well, yeah, but dude, that's a no-win because every time you see the calls going, Apple should do a release that's bug fixes only. Well, they've done that a couple of times. And what did they get hammered on? Oh, there's no new features. So they do a bunch of new features that, of course, new stuff is buggy, code is buggy. Computer code gets more complex probably by an order of magnitude every year,
What do you think happened on the Wi-Fi WPA2 crack incident? Do you think it was the same?
Because that affected everyone.
That was where Apple said, no, there is no fix required. And then they went, oops, yes, there is.
Oh, that was stupid. Yeah. Apple's not beyond being stupid sometimes. They've been stupid before. They're going to be stupid again. There's a lot of IT-only Open Directory binding stuff I've seen. It was just appallingly dumb. But, again, it's... people love with Apple to do this end of the world stuff. They love it to be everything's the end of the world and if Steve were still here and if iOS wasn't still here, wasn't here and all this. And they do this magic thinking. And it's like, back in the old days, I'm like, dude, I've been around since some pretty old days. I remember when Apple released entire lines of computers with substandard power supplies that would burn out because you put too much RAM in them. Okay. Do not tell me about some magic time when Apple had this perfect QA. It has never existed. System 7 was a nightmare when it came out. 8 had bugs all over the place. 9 literally prevented a bunch of programs from working because they changed the file access spec, which to their credit they'd warned about, but it still happened. There isn't an operating system release that has not had some kind of major problem, and it's always been, you know, because something magic time in the past is gone, and back then it wouldn't have happened.
Well, I appreciate your perspective. That's because of your experience. Yeah. I respect and appreciate that perspective. And you told us about some interesting things in the past that kind of open our eyes about the whole thing. Let's move on because we only have a few minutes left. I want to talk about some positive things in the future.
Yeah.
So the iMac Pro is about ready to ship.
Oh, and my God.
What do you think of that? Are you going to get, one? Are you amazed?
My wife is going to get one. She does a lot of video work, a lot of Photoshop
work. I want her checkbook.
I'm going to be paying for that for a while. But, I mean, she does a lot of that kind of work. And her main machine right now is a 2008 Mac Pro. I have three other Mac Pros that I've acquired. Yeah, I have three other cheese graters in my closet because I can't get parts for it anywhere else. So I'm always in fear that it's going to break something I don't have a spare for, and then I have to get a new computer for it anyways.
You seen the upgrade prices when you want to go from the base model up to, say, 128 gig of RAM? And we published an article recently about how those prices really are astounding. You can pay $13,000, $14,000 for a fully loaded machine.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. But it's – I'm looking at – what I'm looking at, and I'm, you know, going to make sure she's okay with that as well, probably going to be around $8,000. But it probably should last about another 7 to 10 years.
Do you think Apple will sell enough of them to make the corporation happy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you're doing that kind of work and you want to do it on a Mac, it's a no-brainer. And, you know, if you want to upgrade the RAM, you have to take it into an Apple authorized service provider or someone who can actually disassemble one of those things. Yeah. Whatever. I mean, you can still get the RAM cheaper that way. There's ways around a lot of this stuff. It's you know, but Apple has been moving away from having doors all over everything for a decade now. It's one of Steve Jobs' earliest things is he hated, you know, cases you could easily get into. He's hated them since the Apple II days. So, you know, the fact that Apple is doing this should surprise no one.
Yeah, we talked about that on a recent podcast, upgrade ability. Some people get bent out of shape and they can't upgrade the RAM, and other people go, well, we bought it with the Macs anyway, so it's an institution, you know, we don't care.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also, if you really look at it, everybody talks about, well, if they only had a mini tower, but if you actually look at the numbers, if you exclude gamers, because gamers are their own world, and they have very unique ways of doing things, but if you exclude them, for the most part, the number of people who really regularly upgrade a system, new hard drives, new RAM, maybe a better video card on a regular basis, they're not even a rounding error. It just doesn't happen that much.
That
to make
was
it,
my suspicion, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at most people who buy Windows boxes, right? They buy a $500 Windows box for home use. Oh, it's slow. What do?
They buy another one.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right. So they're spending $500 every other year anyways. And, you know, my main driver at home is a 2011 17-inch, which still has a quad i7 and 16 gig of RAM and an SSD. It's a great machine. It's also going to be 7 years old, this coming year, and it's still working fine. So Apple's hardware longevity is a little insane.
Well, so as prices come down for RAM, often one gets the idea that, boy, it'd be nice to upgrade, but that's another argument for another day. Do you think Apple is on a firm footing now, back on track on Macintoshes? They got kind of distracted for a while in 15 and 16, but now we have an iMac Pro, and we've got a promised Mac Pro coming this year, maybe?
Do you think they're back? I think they do. A couple of people I know work for Apple in different areas have always said the same thing. Apple does what's best for Apple, and they really understand their market well. And I think what a lot of pundits forget is that they're not the audience. People like, you know, the TMO staff and Gruber and all the pundits, their viewpoints, their perspectives are very weird compared to the average person. And what, you know, I mean, I've had friends who've been in high-level executive meetings when Steve Jobs was alive, and Jobs literally told them, you guys buy a lot of Macs, but quite honestly, I can pick any Apple store, and the number of Macs bought by grandmothers buying their grandchildren graduation gifts will outstrip you in a day and a half. Will outstrip your yearly purchase in a day and a half. Apple knows their market really well, and they're very comfortable with that. And if you look, their enterprise pickup is just off the hook because of the total cost of ownership. And the security features in the new iMac Pros are fantastic. I don't know too many security people who aren't thrilled about those.
Well, there's no touch bar in the iMac Pro. What do you make of that?
That's very hard to do with a USB keyboard.
You couldn't have maybe a wireless keyboard with a secure enclave in there?
Yeah, but it's still hard because now... But now you have to put the secure enclave in the keyboard as well as in the machine, which really makes it hard to have third-party keyboards.
Yeah, that's true. Well, Apple.
You can't just sell secure enclaves to random people. It kind of bypasses the point,
Apple, you can imagine Apple doing that and say, you don't need no stinking third-party keyboard. We gave you the best one you'll ever need.
They're dumb, but I don't think they're quite that dumb. But there is the potential for Face ID in the new iMacs.
Yeah. Yeah.
They do have a camera. They do have that improved secure enclave setup.
Absolutely.
So I'm not saying they will, but I'm saying the potential is definitely there.
Do you think that what's best for Apple would someday maybe be an ARM-based Mac? That discussion comes up from time to time. I'd like to hear your thoughts.
The problem is that one of the big selling points of the Mac is this ease of using other environments. You can boot it into Windows if you want. Using things like VMware is really easy. You can even run ESXi, as the operating system. You can turn a lot of Macs into VMware servers, not just running Fusion, but running the bare metal hypervisor. I am not sure, and I have not seen a lot to suggest this, that there is any way they could make that kind of a transition, because again, this would be the PC. This would be the fifth major CPU transition in this company's history. No one's ever done that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been
almost no one's ever done two, much less they've done four already, with Intel being the last. And I'm not sure
the ability to boot into Windows with Boot Camp, the ability to run other Intel-based virtual machines. The direct access to the hardware, not having to do some sort of Rosetta emulation to run in x86-based software. You'd have to sort of tell the developers, start transitioning all your software over, recompile.
Yeah.
What a mess that would be. Yeah,
and I'm not sure that what they get out of it is worth it. Now, again, Apple knows things that no one else does about their stuff, so hardware might be better enough. I mean, I think the big problem that this isn't so much like an Apple needs. This is a reflection of the fact that in terms of performance and feature set, Intel hasn't done anything new that's interesting in a while. Like I said, I literally have a 7-year-old laptop with a quad core i7. And performance wise, the only reason I've thought about a new MacBook, honestly, is getting parts for the damn thing is going to be impossible. So if it dies, I have to get a new one.
No, the concern is the older Macs can't run the latest version of the operating system, which has the most secure fixes.
I'm running 10.13 on a 7-year-old machine.
Yeah, but pretty soon.
Yeah, and that'll be a factor too.
Yeah. But beyond about 2009 or 10, those machines are not going to run the next version.
But I mean, they're definitely doing better than Jobs was with that, because Jobs used to whack machines off pretty damn recently. People forget that Apple didn't go to Intel just because they were bored. They went to Intel primarily because, IBM told them, we don't care about what you want for the G5. If you want regular speed upgrades to the G5 and you're our only customer who cares, then you can just build your own damn chip foundry. Because IBM's primary customers for that chip was Sony and Microsoft for the Xbox and the PlayStation.
Yeah.
And you don't see a lot of chip upgrades on video game consoles. You don't see a lot of RAM upgrades. It's funny what people get weird about when it comes to upgrades. So could it happen? Sure. Will it? I don't know. I don't think so. Not anytime soon.
Okay. Well, guess what? We just blew our time budget. We are out of time.
Awesome.
What a great discussion. Thank you so much for telling me about your really impressive career and your thoughts about Apple and the Mac It was a lot of fun. Thanks for being on the show with me.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Easiest way is on Twitter, at Binky, B-Y-N-K-I-I. Warning you now, I am prolific. I do tweet storms like other people breathe.
Can I ask you real quick before we close, where did Binky come from? I always wondered about that.
It's a bit of a long story, but basically the root of it is when AOL starts and your first name is John, you don't want to be John 13552213. So, and I happen to have been using that name for a D&D character I'd played for years, and so that's where it came from. There's another longer story behind that, but I'm not sure it's appropriate for a G-rated show.
Okay, great. Well, now we know the story. Thanks for that. Again, thanks for joining me. It was a lot of fun.
Folks, thank you for having me.
Folks, you've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you again next week.